In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking with Annette Leroux. She is Associate Professor of Sociology at Temple University in Philadelphia. We'll be talking about a study that she was involved in that takes a look at the relationship between social class and the way parents think about and go about raising their children and what that means for those kids and the way that they navigate the world and their long-term success. She's written about this in her book, Unequal Childhoods, the subtitle, Class, Race, and Family Life. It is published by the University of California Press. In this book, she makes the argument that class does indeed make a huge difference in the lives and futures of American children. And we'll talk about that in this part of the show. Questions from people who are listening, of course, are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is people just try to be brief so that we can keep the program moving, getting as many people as possible. Anyone's welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Leroux, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
I think that just the place to start is maybe to take note of how problematic maybe this idea of class and its importance is. It's the kind of thing that I'm sure among academics is certain to start an argument. And maybe for people who are not academics, difficult to think about because we like to believe that there is no such thing in the United States. And so the idea that social class could be an important determinant of children's success, and that it might in fact be more important than race, I think that would be difficult for some people to wrap their head around.
Well, in America, we live in a society that believes in individual opportunity and individual effort. And so we tend to downplay the impact that parents' social position has on children's life chances. But by social class, I mean parents' education and their occupation. So by middle-class families, I mean a family where one person has a college degree and they have a job where they have a complex job, they can take a phone call, they have some amount of autonomy at work. That's different than working class where people are closely supervised and they're often high school dropouts or high school graduates.
Mm-hmm. So what you did basically was design a study so that you could look at a number of families, some who were middle class, some who were working class, and some who were poor. You mixed it up, so you had some families that were white and some families that were black. And you and I'm sure some colleagues and graduate students, this would have taken a number of people, obviously you couldn't all have done this all yourself, spent time, some considerable amount of time with these families, trying as much as possible just to fade into the background so that they would do what they would be doing ordinarily, and yet observe pretty closely how it is that the parents and their children interacted, and also some things about how it is that those kids spent their time. And it seemed that the central issue here is how much active parenting, very deliberate sort of cultivation of their children, was going on. And there seemed to be there a very big difference between particularly the middle class parents, whether they were, no matter what their race was, whether they were black or white, a big difference between those parents and what they were doing with their children, and then all of the other parents, the working class and poor parents.
That's correct. We began in public schools and I did classroom observation in third grades. Then we did a two-hour interview first with the mom and then with the dad. We brought them a pie. We wrote them a thank you note. We confirmed the interviews beforehand. So by the time we finished interviewing two people, the people sort of had a sense of us. Then we asked 12 families if we could follow them into their homes. They were paid $350. And we visited 20 times, usually in the space of 1 month. Now, some families did turn us down. About two-thirds of the families agreed. But the families said after a few days especially, things went back to normal, and we could tell because yelling went up and cursing went up in the families. And there's often quite a lot of yelling in families. But the children were only 9 and 10, and it was hard for them to sustain company manners day in and day out.
Mm. So you have the feeling that after, in a relatively short period of time, family life got back to normal, whatever that was, and that your presence and the presence of the other people who took part, who were doing the observation, didn't change the way these people behaved, how they acted, what they said, that it would have been as if you were not there.
Well, I'm sure we always had some impact. And, for example, people wore more clothes. They didn't walk around in their underwear, which some people do in families. But when we asked them, the children said in very specific ways how it was different. They said, my mom talked more. The house was cleaner. But we didn't have a way to understand that there was what we were interested was in the differences in family life. And there it seemed that people more or less, they told us that they went about their lives as they normally do.
Hmm.
And what we noticed was how busy the middle-class families were, white and black. The children were only 9 and 10 years old, but they often had 3 or 4 activities a week. They had piano, they had scouts, they had soccer, they had baseball, they had traveling soccer. And so parents were very busy. And I say that parents were engaged in something I call concerted cultivation, where they took children as a project, and they were trying to develop children's talents and skills.
And Nana, how does that contrast with the parents of kids the parents who were working class and poor parents?
Well, in the middle class families, they enrolled children in many organized activities. So children had, as I said, soccer and baseball during the week. They also reasoned with them, so they answered questions with questions. So you'll see that even if you're out and about, like I was in a posh department store the other day, and there was an 8-year-old who was tumbling around on the women's section with his sibling, and the mother is saying, now, do you think this is a good place to practice wrestling? She didn't say, cut it out, don't do that, which would be a directive. She was asking him a question and asking him to reason it out. And middle-class parents do that, which is often very time-consuming. So middle-class parents enroll kids in organized activities. They engage in a lot of reasoning, and they also supervise kids' lives in institutions where the moms are kind of like guardian angels. They kind of swoop in and intervene on the child's behalf.
Mm-hmm. The other parents, that is the working class and poor parents, had a very different way of approaching this issue of child rearing. And I don't want to make it sound like I thought you certainly weren't saying that somehow that the middle class parents were better parents, but that they were somehow more actively engaged. Was it the case that the other parents, the working class and the poor parents, more had an idea that child development, their children growing up, was just something that kind of followed a natural course and that they didn't have to be so hands-on all the time?
That's absolutely correct. The parents had an approach which I called the accomplishment of natural growth. They worked very hard to provide for their children with limited economic resources. They kept them safe. They got them to the doctor and to school. But they had the notion that children would spontaneously develop and grow and thrive. They didn't have the notion that it was their duty to cultivate the children's talents. So the parents, for example, the kids watched TV, they hung out with their cousin, they played, they had time for spontaneous, unstructured play. The parents gave them directives, they didn't reason with them. And school and doctor's offices were children's own lives. It wasn't that the children's problems became the mother's problems as well. So they have something called the accomplishment of natural growth, which I believe has important strengths for child rearing. They both, I think, have intrinsic strengths and weaknesses. But the problem is when the children get in institutions, the middle class way of child rearing gives children important benefits for white and black children.
Because you argue that somehow it makes them more assertive, perhaps. That is, that when they go out to the world, as they deal with people, particularly adults and authority figures, they consider themselves more on an equal one-to-one level because of the way their parents related to them?
That's correct. There was often a clear boundary between adults and children in the working class and poor communities. And children would spontaneously, they would call me Miss Annette, rather than calling me by my first name, and they called often adults with an honorific title. But in the middle-class communities, children didn't have often the same level of respect for adults. And we saw children often say hateful and ugly things to their parents. I hate you, why you make me do this? You don't ever get it, you always get it wrong. And children who were 9 and 10 would often yell at their parents. And that was a drawback. But, for example, when we were going to the doctor visit with a black middle class boy who I call Alexander Williams, the mom said, okay, Alexander, I want you to be thinking of any questions you have for the doctor. And this is in the car. And Alexander says, well, I have some bumps under my arm from my new deodorant. And she says, okay, you should ask the doctor. And then when we get into the doctor's appointment, Alexander produces his question at the assigned moment. And he also interrupts the doctor and contradicts the doctor. The doctor says that we graft you as you are 10, and he says, I'm not 10. He was 9 3/4. And so he has a sense of entitlement. Mm-hmm. But when we were with the working class or poor families, for example, we were with a poor family that was on welfare, an African-American family, we went to the doctor with them, and the doctor asked the mom, does your son have any birthmarks? And the 8-year-old sister chimes in. She says, I have a birthmark, and pointing to her arm. And mother says, will you just cool it? And the mother was trying to protect the doctor's time, and seeing the doctor's time as valuable, was not training her children to interrupt and interrogate people in positions of authority.
Here, I guess it gets to an issue that some people are concerned about when it comes to families like the middle-class families you talk about, families that are rushed, children that are overscheduled, parents who get this idea that we've got to get the kids in as many different organized activities as possible, so we have to foster their artistic talents and foster their athletic talents, and that among the consequences, the fact that it seems everybody's always going someplace, the family's going off in 5 different directions, mom may be taking one child one place, dad may be taking another child another place, and it definitely leads to a pace of life that's much more hectic. And I know some people have raised this question, well, is that so good for kids? Where did we get the idea, or some people get the idea, that that kind of parenting was what they should be doing, that in fact there had to be this very deliberate and sometimes intense cultivation of children?
Well, I see in the book, my mission is trying to point out things that are often invisible to people but we need to take seriously. For example, Americans often think about race, but they don't think about class. There are child-rearing experts who will tell you that this is bad for children, this hectic pace. But to be sure, children like their activities, the middle-class children. They weren't nearly as busy as their mothers were the people who were the busiest. Because, for example, we did what the kids did, so we just kind of hung out with the kids. And the kids would get into their uniform, and they would just wait. But the mom, meanwhile, would have found the uniform, told the kid to put it on, chided the kid to hurry up, found the keys, answered the phone, gotten the chairs out, gotten the ice water, put out the dog, found her sunglasses and locked the car and gotten locked the house and gotten everyone into the car. So the mom and the dads were much busier than the kids. Now, when we interviewed the parents, we asked them, when you were third grade, what was your life like? And none of them had activities as busy as their children. They had lives much more like the working class and poor children, where they watched TV for countless hours and played outside. So it's a little bit unclear. One of the factors is many middle class parents object to TV. They think that TV is harmful for children. And there's also many parents clearly want to give their children advantages, and they think that these will help their children get into college, help them in the workplace, and probably some of these skills will help them in the workplace.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Annette Leroux. She is a associate professor of sociology at Temple University. That's in Philadelphia. And she is the author of a book that lays this information out here based on the study that she was involved in. The title of her book is Unequal Childhoods, Class, Race, and Family Life. It's published by the University of California Press. And indeed, as we have been discussing, makes this argument that social class does make a difference in the lives of children, and that you find that middle class parents, as compared with those who are working class or poor, have real different ideas about raising their children and how actively involved they need to be in that process, which then also does indeed have an effect on the children and how they think about themselves and how they negotiate the world. And it certainly should be available in a bookstore near you if you are interested in taking a look at it. And questions here on the program are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here. We'll start with Charleston and our line 4. Hello.
Yes. I would like to give a bit of perspective here on the subject matter of your guest. class in America, you know, is obvious, but it's trivialized, and you can move up. Well, I want to articulate my experience as a poor, a lumpen white child, where the criminal element was all around. The authoritarianism of the nuclear family, dominated by a father, and how that philosophy of children to be seen and not heard, and that was enforced with violence. Well, coming from that background, and then trying to understand the world I lived in, was marked by one specific that I adhered to, which was to work, that you had to have gainful employment. And my father, who was an unemployed alcoholic, and a mother who could barely work and feed us, proved to me by that example that somehow the work ethic, if that's what it was, seemed to be what Lyndon Johnson called the light at the end of the tunnel. You know, most times it's a freight train coming the other way, but for that class of people. But nevertheless, I did learn from that and sought unskilled work my whole life because I weren't qualified for anything better. And going back to school for someone born in the 30s and raised through the 40s and 50s was not part of the paradigm of that era. But I guess the final thing is that using that as an example, I raised seven children of my own, both boys and girls, and that's what I taught them, that you had to work and that you had to provide for yourself in both the short and the long run. I mean, we had a big old house we all lived in, and we managed to get through that. None of the children had ever been in trouble from that day to this. Never, you know, any sort of activity with the law. And all were productive citizens, the children of their own. But that I just want to give you that bit of history to point up the class society as it is, and that has not changed. And it's a terrific burden on a larger group now of capitalist society. So I'll ring off and listen for your answer. And thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Professor Leroy. And that story caused you to have any reflections on the kind of people that you got to know when you were doing your study?
Yes, there's a white working class family in the book that we call the Yanelli family. Both the parents dropped out when they were sophomores in high school. He works as a house painter, and she works cleaning houses. And for many years, they both worked under the table. But they really wanted to buy a house. So for him, it was a big, he took a pay cut to get a job where he would pay Social Security. He still didn't have a pension, but he just simply wanted to pay taxes so they could potentially buy a house. So for many of these working class and poor white families, their lives are very similar to poor and working class black families, but often they're invisible to us in the broader society. And we don't think that, in fact, there are substantial numbers of poor and working class whites. And in this instance, they, for them, their big goal was to get a job that had benefits. And that was considered a good job, one that had health benefits, because they were paying. When they went to the doctor, they didn't have health insurance. And, you know, if you have health insurance, as I do, you see that your provider actually takes a discounted fee. They actually had to pay the whole fee, which almost nobody pays, and they were paying it on incomes of $9 an hour.
So is part of the difference between the middle-class families and the others the fact that they have the luxury of being able to give their children more time because they're not quite so concerned about making a living?
The middle-class families have substantially more resources. They have economic stability. They have a car often that they can drive children around rather than taking young children with strollers on the bus, waiting for buses that do not come. They have private washers and dryers in their houses rather than going to laundromats. So there are many ways that middle-class families, they're just getting through the day is easier because of their economic resources. But this is compounded also by a set of cultural beliefs about what children need to succeed. And middle-class parents, as other research has shown, often stress curiosity, self-direction, and understanding how and why things happen, while working-class and poor parents think they're giving kids an advantage if they teach them to follow orders, kind of like you would do in the military.
Mm. In the middle-class families that you looked at, did all of the moms work outside the home?
Yes, some of the moms worked part-time, but all the moms worked. And some of these moms had very fancy careers where they had to travel for their jobs, and they had secretaries. And they were incredibly busy. And actually, one of the families in the book, the Tallinger family, they had three children. The only two were school age. And it got to the point where the mom said, one of us had to put our career on the shelf, and it might as well be me, because she made less money than her husband, as most women do. And it was just the travel, the overnight travel, was simply too difficult for them to sustain, given all the children's organized activities.
Let's talk with someone else. Next caller is in Aurora. That would be line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to be doing exactly what the man did before me. I came from a working class mother, very hard working class mother, immigrant. No father. Father had died at an early age. And when I married, I decided if I had any children, I would forget about that I lived on the wrong side of the street, the wrong side of the town. That didn't bother me. And I just went along doing everything, becoming a Girl Scout leader, and the girls were in Girl Scouts. And I just treated myself like I wanted to be and give the children what I felt they would have a happier life. And I most wanted them to be feel that they could be and do what they wanted to be. And they all graduated from college. Two became teachers. One is a registered nurse working on her master's. My son became an engineer. And I still feel, though, that the way they talk to me, that they're not as liberated as I wish they would have been. But I felt that it really didn't bother me. I didn't let it affect me that I lived on the wrong side of this town. And I don't think that really matters. If you can take the kids to the library, you can take them downtown to open a bank account, you know, give them all the things that you know will make them feel good about themselves, wherever you live. And that was my means. And then I went back to school and became a nurse. And I was glad I did, because from that doing, one of my children made a very big decision in her life. She felt if I could go on and do what I did, she could do something in her life that changed her life for the better. So I think, I guess my main thought is that if you can do something about it where you live, like the saying goes, blossom where you were born, I just, if you can break down the barricades for yourself, you can make it. Do you have anything to say?
Well, I think, truly you're an American success story, and there is what social scientists call this upward mobility, and there's also downward mobility. And people argue about how much upward and downward mobility there are, but some people think as much as a quarter or a third of the population is either upwardly mobile or downwardly mobile, and people can, in fact, improve their life chances and the chances of their children. But I think what sociologists try to do is imagine, for example, you want to become a millionaire. And there are people from rags to riches who become millionaires, but the best way to become a millionaire is to inherit wealth. And that's how most people become millionaires. Mm-hmm. And similarly, most, for example, we know when children are only 4 years old that kids whose moms have a college degree know more letters and are more likely to spell their name than children whose moms are high school dropouts. And we also know that parents' education predicts SAT scores. So we know that children gain a tremendous advantage when their parents have advantages. And although there's some people who move up and move down, that's not the most fundamental pattern in the U.S.
Well, I think your book is very good. I hope some mothers and fathers read it and maybe be able to make better lives for themselves and their children. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, Professor Leroy, when you were talking with the parents of the working class and poor families, whether they told you that they felt, was there any feeling on their part that there was something that they wished that they could do for their children or could give to them that they wished that they could do but they couldn't because of their class position?
Well, many of the parents felt very powerless at school, and they felt trapped and disappointed in their interactions with the school. So, for example, they would go to the school and they would want their kids to succeed, and then they felt kind of bamboozled by teachers. And also they felt powerless at the school. Teachers have a legal responsibility to turn in parents if the parents are violating current codes of conduct regarding discipline, which includes, for example, if kids come in with marks from a belt. But many of the parents believed in corporal punishment, and in 17th, 18th, and 19th century America, corporal punishment was the way to go. This is a new standard. It's like a fashion, kind of like we have fashions in clothing and makeup. This is a fashion for child rearing. Now, it's a fashion that people have strong feelings about, but the reality is that middle-class parents can engage in verbal abuse, saying, like, I don't want to be your mother anymore, and nothing will happen to them. But if working-class and poor kids come in with marks, they are at danger for catastrophe, which is to have their kids taken away from them. And white and black parents expressed great distrust of the school and of doctors and worried that they would come and take their kids away.
Hmm. I think you get an interesting point here because, again, one of the big differences, apparently, and again, this correlates with the class, is that the middle-class parents were more comfortable with, more willing to confront teachers, administrators, and advocate in a very aggressive way for their children. If they felt that their children's needs were not being served, they were going to go down to the school and they're going to make a big noise until they feel that their kids' needs are being served. And that somehow the other parents, the working class parents, didn't feel comfortable in that role, or perhaps they felt that even if they tried, they would not be listened to. And so their kids were missing the kind of level of advocacy that the middle class kids got from their own parents.
That's correct. For example, in the book, there's a story of a white middle class family where, which just happened at the school, and their son came home in September, October, and learned that the holiday song lyrics, there was going to be a Hanukkah song, but there was a song that said, "Come, let us bow and worship before him." And they objected to this holiday song because they thought it violated church and state. They complained to the choir teacher, who dismissed their concern, no pointing out the Hanukkah song. They complained to the principal, who said it was only a song. They wrote a letter to the superintendent. They asked the superintendent to review it with the lawyer. And in fact, they yanked the holiday song from the program. And so over little things, middle-class parents often activated tremendous resources to try to get their kids in the gifted program when the children didn't qualify, to get a teacher that the parents thought would be good for the children. And the working-class and poor parents went to school, too, but often they would be shut down by teachers. For example, a white working-class mom, her son was sort of a goofball, and he was always getting in trouble. He was the sort of kid that would yank out a chair from a third grade girl and she'd fall on the floor. He was always getting in, you know, little pranks like that. And she would go to school because her son was being beat up on the playground. And the teacher said, well, he's doing things that provokes this. He's immature. And you need to seek counseling, which neither she nor her husband believed in. And so she felt powerless. She said the school has an answer for everything. And they ultimately taught their son to defend himself on the playground, which was a strict violation of every school rule, and he ended up getting suspended for that, but they thought that was the only recourse they had.
Let's go to another caller here. The next person in line is in Lafayette, Indiana, on our line 4. Hello.
Hello. Earlier you mentioned middle-class parents favoring many, and perhaps too many, activities for their children. This is just a detail, but I'm curious, how much do the children press their parents to allow what might be an overload and thus contribute to a frazzled life.
We were there 20 days, and so we were only there during one season. And we certainly heard stories about middle-class parents saying kids wanted things. So actually, we heard that much more in working-class and poor families. If children had an activity, which was extremely rare, it almost always was the child's idea. In middle-class parents, part of the problem was that so many kids were in so many activities that the houses were huge, and there weren't that many children on the street, that there weren't playmates outside the door for middle-class children to play with. So sometimes middle-class mothers would maneuver to have the child choose an activity because they were worried about the child not having anyone to play with outside. So in the white middle-class family that we visited, the parents, we were there one night. We stayed overnight one night with most of the families. And the girl was sort of hopping up and down and dancing. And the mom was saying, "Well, do you want to sign up for softball?" And she said, "Oh, I don't know." And she said, "Well, remember last year you didn't have anyone to play with." And the girl says, "Oh, I don't know." And then her mom says, "Well, you know, Melanie might be playing. Maybe you could see if she's going to play." And the girl said, "I don't know." And she says, "What do you think I should do?" And the mom says, "I don't know. I want it to be your decision." Right? This is the same. I want your decision.
Lots
and the girl
of discussion
says,
and balancing.
That's right. And the girl said, "Okay, I'll play." Now, the mom had sort of coaxed the girl along, but had wanted her to seem like her decision.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Let's go to our next caller, and that would be in Belgium, over by Danville, line number 2. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering, your guest here has done a research in the fairly recent past, but also in the recent past here and going on today, is the social stratification in America is dramatically changing. The middle class, the upper middle class is rapidly going into the more affluent class, and the poorer middle class is going into the working class, and the working class is falling into the poorer class, and the poorer class are just giving a horrible situation because of the situation that's going on today in the United States. Seems though we're going to run into a lot more problems with child rearing, according to your instructions. Do you have any points about that?
Well, America's economic situation is clearly worsening, and manufacturing jobs, which were great jobs for high school graduates, have clearly gone overseas and largely disappeared. And so taxation policies have also changed, so we do have a rising pattern of inequality. What happens generally is that probably cultural practices like child rearing change slowly over time, probably over 20, 30 years, not over a year or two. But in general, I think what you would expect is that parents who are college graduates will have one set of practices. People who are high school graduates or high school dropouts will have another set of practices. But one thing that surprised us is we thought that the working class and poor families would compare themselves to middle class people, people who owned houses, had managerial jobs, earned $80,000 a year. And they didn't. They compared themselves to people who were within their social world. So, for example, a black mom who was in a housing project, she compared herself to the moms who were on drugs, who didn't take care of their kids and didn't do anything for the kids. And she said, "Look, I'm a really good mom." And so America has become so stratified. I mean, I'm sure like in Chicago area, if you ever go up there, people often never go into neighborhoods where they meet people who are of a different economic circumstance.
Well, the point I was trying to make on is here in the Midwest, and definitely in places like North Carolina and some places, jobs are disappearing so rapidly and being moved so quickly out of areas that there really is no chance for these things to move along in any sort of smooth way. It seems they're going to have to change rapidly to keep up with the rapid changes.
It's true, but the jobs are disappearing, but we know that parents who are high school graduates or high school dropouts or have community college, their children tend not to do that well in school. And partly middle-class parents are giving their kids enormous advantages in vocabulary that facilitates their school success. So in the end, I'm not that optimistic. Even though parents clearly want their children to succeed and do better than themselves, I think we're looking at a generation where probably the children won't do that much better than their parents and may do worse.
Thank you very much, Melanie.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. And let me introduce again our guest. We're talking with Annette Leroux. She is Associate Professor of Sociology at Temple University. She is the author of the book Unequal Childhoods, Class, Race, and Family Life. It's published by the University of California Press. It's the basis of a study that she was involved in, looking at a number of families, middle class, working, and poor, some of them white, some of them black, looking at particularly the ways that parents thought about child rearing and what child development was all about, and just how actively they needed to be involved in that process, and finding that the middle-class parents tended to be much more intensively involved in a deliberate kind of cultivation of their kids. In fact, she coined a term for that she calls it concerted cultivation, and that for the other parents, they took a much more, their attitude was more like children was, their development was something that was kind of a natural thing, that it was just going to happen, and they did not have to be so directly involved. The result is different kinds of kids with different sorts of attitudes about how they move and work in the world. And again, if you're interested in finding out more about that, you can take a look at the book Unequal Childhoods. And questions here are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. One of the other really dramatic kind of differences between these families, and something that I'm sure has caught a lot of people's attention, is that within the middle class families, there was a much more really intense kind of hostility sometimes between siblings, and even sometimes directed towards parents. And you talked about a little earlier that it would be much more likely that within one of the middle class families, you would find somebody saying, "I hate you," or I hate my brother, I hate my sister," and that you're not going to hear that as much in the other families. Why do you think that is?
Well, that surprised us, because in the working class and poor families, other research has shown the importance of extended families. And it's not that the kids didn't ever have the squabbles, they did, but there was sort of a venom and a viciousness and a hatred that middle class kids felt comfortable expressing, and that the parents were aware of. So kids would, for example, one kid, they were playing baseball outside, and one boy, Spencer, said, "Pretend the ball is his older brother's head." Or another girl said, "I hate him," about a brother, and the mom said, "I know." And it was just, this was just the way it was. And partly middle-class parents stress individualism. They stress the development of an individual's child's talents. And that's what, you know, the soccer shatters the dinner hour, because everyone's racing around to develop a child's talents. And if the hearth was the center of the 19th century home, the calendar is the center of the middle class home, because everybody is so busy. But in the working class and poor families, it's a lot of work to manage resources when you don't have a lot of economic resources and money is very tight. But there's an emphasis, you have to depend on your brothers and sisters and your cousins and your aunts and your uncles. And those are the people who will help you get through the day.
Hmm. Certainly, what you see in the middle class families is this encouragement of children to be assertive, to speak up, to talk about what they think and what they feel, and for parents to engage them that way. They're listened to. That's encouraged. Is this other thing, the fact that they might blurt out something that was really uncomfortable, that we wouldn't, as parents, that we wouldn't like, is that a necessary downside of encouraging the more positive expression, or is there some way to deal with that and get at the stuff that we don't like while at the same time encouraging the stuff that we do?
Well, that's hard for me to say. I will say we saw it in all the middle class families. We saw it in the black middle class families and the white middle class families. And we saw, for example, the black middle class kids be quite rude to their parents, say, "You never get it," or, you know, act disgusted with their parents in a way that the black and white working class and poor families, it was just intolerable. It was completely not possible that kids would act that way. But I think it is, I think it's a necessary downside of encouraging kids to be verbal and develop. And I mean, one thing we noticed is that middle-class kids had very broad horizons. They had been on planes. They had been to other states. They knew people had been to Europe. A lot of these traveling teams or choirs in middle school sometimes go to Europe or they go to other states. There are these huge fundraising activities. And children had a very broad horizon. While a lot of the working class and poor kids had never even been downtown, they hadn't been 15, 20 miles away. But we noticed that middle-class kids were a little bit blasé. They sort of had this ennui. They were a little bit bored. They were easily proclaimed themselves to be bored. And they were hard to impress. And one sort of indication of this, a little one, is that we always had a pizza party, an exit party, when we were done observing. And the working class and poor kids were thrilled by this. They were really excited about the pizza. They wanted to talk about what kind of pizza, what kind of plates. We got a cake. The middle-class kids did not feel thanked by that because for them, pizza was routine. And we would see these soccer parties at the end of the season, and the kids wouldn't, you know, worry about saying thank you because for them, it was just a normal part of their life. They got excited about things like getting on planes or staying at hotels.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with some other callers. So we have next caller on line number one in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I had a question. I don't know where you did your study, but if you saw any differences between, like within a class, but between different settings, like say the lower working class between an urban setting and a rural setting, because the poor people in a rural setting will probably have a car, but they won't be able to use public transportation. And I was just wondering if you saw any differences with that. And I'll just hang up and let you answer.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call.
I did part of the research in a Midwestern community similar to Champaign, a college town, and we found very similar patterns there, actually. There were some differences. There wasn't as much crime and violence as in the large northeastern city where we did the observations and interviews. But I was surprised how similar the patterns were, actually, between non-urban areas and urban areas. And I think neighborhoods were very racially stratified, both in these other small towns and in large cities. One thing which I wanted to stress is that it wasn't that race didn't have any impact on people's lives. For example, the family lives in racially stratified neighborhoods. Some of these dads who had master's degrees, women would cling to their purses when they walked down on the street. There were ways that race made a difference. But in what we looked at, how kids spent their time, were they in organized activities, did the parents reason with them, how did they monitor their activity, lives in schools and doctor's offices, class was very important. And white and black middle-class children had a great deal in common, and they had relatively little in common with poor children.
Next caller is in Urbana, line number two. Hello. Is the caller there, line two in Urbana?
Line two, I'm sorry, yeah.
Yes.
I'm curious to what degree the children you studied were conscious of their family's class status. I mean, even were they conscious of it, and was their awareness accurate? For example, a poor child might believe he or she is, in fact, well off. And to what degree did that consciousness impact their success? And I'll listen off the air. Thanks very much.
Thanks for the question.
Most of the families thought of themselves as middle class. Families that I categorized as working class, they would report themselves to be middle class, and most people in America report themselves to be middle class. What was interesting is that the middle class family, the white middle class boy, the Tallinger family, they lived in a house that cost $200,000. They had a swimming pool. Their parents made over $150,000 a year. They were extremely affluent they were really upper middle class. And at the end of the interview, if I asked him if he could change one thing in his life, what would he change? And he said that we would have more money, because he wanted to go to a private school where his friends from soccer went, and the family didn't have enough money for him to go to that private school. So kids often had a very distorted sense where, again, the working class people compared themselves to other people in the neighborhood. They didn't compare themselves across class lines. Mm.
So that raises an interesting question about when there were opportunities for kids to be involved in organized programs, for example, like sports, what you just mentioned. Was there very much mixing of kids from different class backgrounds?
There wasn't very much, partly because the neighborhoods were spread so far apart. No. Occasionally there were neighborhoods that would draw kids from both working class and middle class neighborhoods for the same baseball team. But that was more the exception than the rule. And also there were more activities in middle class neighborhoods, which were often volunteer based, scouts and soccer and so forth. And so there was more of more activities to choose from in the middle class neighborhoods.
Next caller, Chicago Line 3. Hello.
Hi, I'm just appalled by your tale of these middle-class children who can't feel gratitude, and I have a two-part question. One, did the religious practices of the family make any difference? And secondly, as these middle-class parents are teaching entitlement to their children, are they teaching them social responsibility? Because I feel that these kids who can't say thank you because pizza is something they have all the time, I'm wondering what type of future citizens they might make.
Well, some of the families did go to church. The churches tend to be racially segregated, and the black families had a notion of creating a positive black role model for their children. Many of the churches, the middle-class children, did in fact have activities that were formally for social responsibility. For example, with the white middle-class Girl Scout troop, they did cookies for the homeless. But what we were struck with was that the children didn't really seem to understand. There wasn't anything that really connected them to the homeless. Mostly they were just bagging cookies in the evening in the school gym. And so their lives seemed very disconnected from the lives of children who were less fortunate than themselves. But let me add one thing, in that there were ways in which class did not matter as well. Some of the families had a sense of humor, and some of them did not. Some of them were neat and clean, and some of them were very messy. Some of our messiest houses were middle-class homes, where things often would be just totally chaotic, especially upstairs. The beds weren't made, the clothes were on the floor, et cetera, et cetera. So we found ways in which class didn't matter as well. And some of the moms were warm, and some of them treated their kids to be very courteous, and other families put less strain on that. And there was some of that that was not connected to social class. But the sense of entitlement about, for example, in the study, there was a white middle-class kid who missed a school party because he went out with his mom. And he came back the next day, and he said, "Where's my cupcake?" because he knew that there had been cupcakes the day before, and he had missed it. And the teacher was annoyed about that, but that shows the sort of sense of entitlement that children get when they're often middle class. Mm.
We're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. I'm sure that there is more in this book than we have discussed, so if people are interested, they can seek it out. Again, it's titled Unequal Childhoods, and it's published by the University of California Press by our guest, Annette LaRoe. She is Associate Professor of Sociology at Temple University. And thanks very much, Professor LaRoe, for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And also, we would want to thank Joe Patty at WRTI for helping set up this high-quality connection for us this morning.